Good afternoon to everybody. First of all, thanks so much for inviting me here. It's an extremely exciting conference. I would like to share with you all this excitement that is coming out of transit observation. I completely agree with the speakers that talked this morning and in the early afternoon. We are really living in the golden age of exosolar planet. It's not just about the quantity of new planets that are being discovered and the rate of this discovery, but it's also the fact that already today we can probe their atmosphere. The reason there is all this excitement about transiting planets is because today is the technique that is allowing us basically to tell something about not only the components, but also the thermal structure of this planet. Now, first of all, just to put some numbers in place, when we're measuring just the transit of the planet, we are measuring basically just the ratio between the surface of the planet with respect to the surface of the star, and we're talking about 1% if the star is a G-type of star and the planet is a Jupiter. But we're also talking about roughly 1% if the star is smaller, an M-dwarf, and if you're talking instead of a Earth-sized planet, a so-called super-Earth, so something that's slightly more massive. And so that's because of this number that actually today I share the opinion of David Chorbanow that we might be able very soon to look at habitable environment through transit because of these favorable type of ratio. Now, since my bias are atmosphere, the reason why I personally love transits are because, again, are telling us about this atmosphere of these exotic planets. And if the planet have no atmosphere, the entire idea here is that it is passing in front of the star at a certain particular lambda, particular wavelength, then I can measure the radius of the planet, and it would expect to be a certain radius. And then I change wavelength, and the radius should be roughly always the same. If there is no atmosphere, of course, same thing if I change again wavelength. And certainly this is not the case if we think there is an atmosphere, and that's the entire idea of using primary transit technique to probe their atmosphere. The idea that at different wavelengths, the radius of the planet might look larger or smaller depending on the molecule they're absorbing there. So if we are interested in looking at the atmosphere, we're really talking about probing a very thin annulus, the limb of the planet, divided by the surface of the star. So this number, of course, is very small. It's roughly 0.1%. Again, if we're talking about gas giant, favorable target could be much smaller for a tougher target. And so, for instance, at the terminator and the limb for a Earth-sized planet, a Earth-like planet, will be definitely much smaller. But then the guiding parameter that tells us if we can do a measurement or not is the scale out of the atmosphere, which tells us basically how much the atmosphere is extending or not. And so roughly the scale out for a Earth-like planet is 8 km, and the scale out is about 100 km or 500 km in a case of a hot Jupiter, because the planet is hot, the main component is light, is hydrogen, and so that's why actually we're so successful in looking at a gas giant planet. But this is just for primary. Certainly, there is a complementary technique, and the speaker before me have extensively described you what it means doing secondary transit. But so with this method, we are in one part measuring the relative dimension star and planet like in the primary, but then we have a second part we're measuring basically the ratio between the flux of the planet divided by the flux of the star. And certainly we all know that the planet and the star are not blackbody, but if I consider them as blackbody in first order approximation, then it will see that an object that is pretty hot then will compare with the star in a pretty good way. And again, that's why hot Jupiter are such good targets. And the more I'm moving towards relatively low temperature, what I need to do is move more towards longer wavelengths in the infrared, because this is exactly where colder planet would peak. And then, of course, if planets are not transiting, but their signature is not negligible with respect to the one of the star, You might even think of doing the combined light star planet, and this was a brilliant idea done by Harrington and collaborator in 2006, probing basically the phase modulation of Upsilon Andromeda B at 24 micron. Okay, now if you're talking about combined light or secondary transits, we are no more basically looking at the photons of the star transmitted by the atmosphere of the planet. We are more looking basically at photons that are directly emitted from the planet if we're talking about the infrared, or reflected if we are talking more about the visible. And I will talk a little bit more about the infrared later on, what kind of implication we have. But just as an example, I will show you, you've certainly seen this several times, but it's just amazing light curve of the planet at P7 done by Kepler. And of course, if planets are extremely hot, even if we are looking at measurement in the visible, we might still have some emission from the planet, because then the temperature of the planet becomes non-negligible with respect to the one of the star. Now, if we talk about the composition, we know for certain that at least a handful of these hot Jupiter definitely contains sodium in the atmosphere, so they're very bad for blood pressure. But sodium was definitely the first element to be probed in a hot Jupiter atmosphere. I would say the history begins there with the discovery by Charbonneau and collaborator in 2002 of sodium using Hubble's this measurement, and it was confirmed from the ground on another planet and in the same planet, both the Redfield and Snellen. So we certainly know that at least in these two most famous attributors, HD189733 and HD209458b, sodium is present. I really hope to see more measurements. At the moment, we have a lot of hot Jupiters that can be probed with this technique, and so it would be nice to put everything in context and start to look at the abundance that can be retrieved in different planets, so we can decisively understand what's going on and why we might see more abundant in some planet and less abundant in others. If we want to move on the chemistry of carbon and oxygen and possibly nitrogen and sulfur, then of course we all started thinking that these planets are in chemical equilibrium, because that's where you want to start. And then there were models suggesting that photochemistry might actually have something to say in this atmosphere, because these planets are almost sitting on the star, so of course they're very radiated. But we still don't completely understand if some of the abundances of gases that we are retrieving for the observation are more due to photochemistry, or maybe if is actually what needs to be changed is the carbon versus oxygen ratio, and so the metallicity might change. And there are already papers out there proposing different scenarios, and it would be very, very nice to be able to nail down a little bit more, a little bit better, more accurately, the mixing ratio of all these components. So water vapor was certainly one of the most searched for species in this atmosphere. It was predicted to be far from being negligible. So, and it was proposed to be present in the planet HD209458b in 2008. No, sorry, it's 2007. By Borriman, looking at measurement in Knudsen using STIS, and so being responsible for an extra absorption, basically, in the visible. We propose that water could be the explanation of this band photometry measured with primary transit, with Spitzer. We propose that actually the discrepancy, especially between 5.8 and 3.6, could be due to the absorption of water. This beautiful spectrum, a recording with IRS by Grillmer and collaborator, the model is by Anne Burrows, is showing basically that the absorption of water in the atmosphere can actually fit pretty well this data. And of course there is probably more, but 90% of this data is actually just fitted by water. So we start to be confident that this water is probably there. These are our measurements, always taken by our group with the same technique we did for HD1NI. This is HD2NI for FAB. And also here, just water as a first order approximation is actually fitting pretty well this data. But again, here we're talking about band photometry, so we will see what we can say more when we introduce the spectroscopy. Methane. Okay, we were not expecting methane at all. Everybody was searching for CO, and we were looking for CO as well. So actually, when Gaussen and Mark showed me this spectrum, low resolution spectrum, diamond micmus, we were all a little bit puzzled to not being able to fit entirely CO in. And the more we were looking at this data, the more we got convinced that actually methane could provide a pretty good explanation. But again, back then we were expecting that methane could be fossilized much more efficiently on this planet, and so we were not expecting a huge quantity. But then we will see actually what kind of conclusion we can take out of this. I just want to point out that Matthew and Sarah also look at this data, and they're obtaining something very similar to what we proposed back then. Water and methane can fit this data, again, 90% level, but there must be more molecule in, of course. Now, carbon dioxide, also carbon dioxide, was not properly we were not expecting that, but again, looking at some dayside data taken with NICMOS, CO2 was really fitting very well, actually, in this part of the spectrum. And so a combination of carbon dioxide, methane, and water seems to be the key, at least, to explain the spectrum. Now, I should put a little bit of caution, though, in all these models. You have actually to appreciate the fact that today the line list that we're using to basically model this molecule most of the time are actually not that accurate. So in particular, water at the moment is very well known with higher accuracy because it has been obtained ab initio calculations. And so we can actually calculate the absorption of water, the strength of the line list, at different temperature, at different wavelengths, with very high precision. We can't do that at all for methane. Methane is known at room temperature, but and there are bits and pieces out there at different wavelength region at high temperature, but it's not known at the level of accuracy we would need to do a good spectral retrieval of these atmospheres. And so when Caitlin and I, but I'm sure Sarah and Maggie have the same issue, are proposing a mixing ratio, you have to take that with a little bit of caution, because line list, actually, if they're not accurate, can tell you basically a number with an order of magnitude of error. So we really need to be careful when we're saying we're retrieving this amount, because again, line lists most of the time are not known at the level of precision. And so it's true that CO2 might be abundant there, but first of all, the abundance of CO2 here depends on the temperature pressure profile you're using. They're actually coupled as an information. And on top of that, also CO2 is not known at the level of accuracy we would need to know exactly how much is in this atmosphere. So we did the same thing with NICMOS for HD2O9, and also the combination of these three molecules seems to agree with your observation. And in both cases, we provided some potential mixing ratios, but again, we need to be a little bit careful here. And so since they seem actually to share the main components in their atmosphere, we started to have a look what are the differences in terms of possible TP profile, where this molecule could absorb. And of course, there is a lot of degeneracy here, and I will tell you a little bit more in a minute. Of course, we had the spectra at very wide wavelength range, and a very high spectral resolution, we will be able to retrieve something as accurate as we're doing every day for Earth. But certainly, we are not there at this point. But we are close. Okay, so looking at AGA-189733b, putting together basically the data recorded from NICMAS with multiple photometry data coming from Spitzer, then definitely water emitting can explain 90% of this point, but you can actually put in a non-negligible amount of CO2 and CO. And actually, the point of 4.5 recorded by the Zeran collaborator seems to suggest actually there is something like that in the atmosphere. So again, we could see those two molecules because are probably the main components, but also CO2 and CO might be in this atmosphere. To change a little bit of planet, because otherwise we are always talking about 189 and 209. We looked at the transmission spectrum of the planet X01b detected by McCullough and collaborator. And now, for this particular planet, we were particularly lucky because, as you can see, the spectral resolution started really to increase. And so it's much easier than for a modeler like me to try to understand what's going on. But also here, when actually the situation is much improved with respect to having just a few photometry data, and I can try to convince you that the components are reasonable. This is just, you put just some water, you put water and methane, and then water, methane, and CO2, and then you might be able to add a little bit of CO. CO has an absorption that is slightly weaker with respect to the other one, so it's sometimes it's masked a bit. Even in this case, we can talk about degeneracy. And the reason is actually when you're probing transmission with transmission spectroscopy, we actually don't know what is the value or the radius of the planet at the 1 bar level. And so somehow when we fit the model, we have to make an assumption. And so of course, if we fit the radius, if the 1 bar level radius is slightly lower, then you can put more molecular abundances. If it's slightly higher, just the opposite. And to remove the degeneracy, I think we really need to have a very wide range of molecule, a very wide range of wavelengths and spectroscopy to be able to remove that. So even transmission spectroscopy might have some degeneracy when we try to retrieve the composition. And then Heather did a very good job in talking about constraint of horizontal thermal structure, so I won't dwell into here. Yep. I will talk a little bit more before the end of my talk about the vertical thermal structure. And for those of you who are not necessarily familiar with atmospheric behavior, here is a case of the Earth. So these are three spectra that were recorded from satellite data. And as you can see, basically, while the polar region spectrum looks very flat, the one probing the desert or the mid-latitude are actually showing features which are actually much stronger. And it's not that the mixing ratios are changing, not at all. What is changing here is only the thermal structure, the vertical thermal structure. Unfortunately, if we're seeing even our Earth from space and we see something like this, we might be tempted to say there are no molecules absorbing at all. And this is not the case. And so we need to be very careful because unfortunately when we're doing the retrieval, especially when we're looking at emission spectroscopy data, we need to retrieve both the thermal structure and the abundances in order to understand what's going on. So that's where the degeneracy comes from. And so with Kathleen Griffith, we started to look at a different TP profile. For instance, these are some of our work for the planets HD209458b, and I'm sure the Maggio and Sara did something similar. And so we try to see when we change the thermal profile and we change the contribution function. So basically, at what level of the atmosphere each molecule is absorbing more strongly. if there is a degeneracy or not. And so these are actually the results. Even just for a few cases, you can see there actually there are multiple solutions that you can retrieve from a combination of spectroscopy and photometry. And of course, if instead of band photometry, we had spectroscopy also in the middle infrared, of course, the degeneracy will be less. So we need to be a little bit careful when we're talking about inversion on inversion, because most of the time, I'm not saying always, but most of the time, the data are not necessarily supporting very conclusive type of information. And so, for instance, this is just a case of X01B that I show you the transmission spectrum. If we look at the four bands, photometry bands recorded by IRAC, these are just two possible spectra with the same composition of the terminator, but with two completely different TP profiles. And so this is just to say we need to be a little bit careful until we don't have a more clear idea what's going on to talk about inversion yes, inversion no, because chances are things are not entirely accurate yet. And then I will show you something similar. These are all the data that were recorded in secondary transit measurements for the planet HD19733b. And we agree with Madhu and Sarah in the overall composition, more or less. And we were pretty happy with this image until something different happened. And what happened was, our team, but several teams actually doing something very similar, we started to have some data from the ground. And so the combination of the ground with space, space-based telescope data are providing more and more constraint. And so we thought we had a little bit the solution of what's going on that atmosphere, but looking at what IRTF data start to tell us, well, IRTF data in the K-band is actually overlapping pretty well with the measurement from Hubble and NICMAS. But then looking at the L-band, in the L-band, there are some huge signatures that are completely out of scale with respect to the all our signature. But if you actually integrate over the band, the Spitzer band of 3.6, you obtain, again, exactly the same measurement that was obtained by Sherbonne and collaborator in 2008. And so looking at this feature, actually, we think this is a signature coming out from the thermosphere, probably, something not completely in thermal equilibrium. And so we need more data to understand what's going on, if it's fluorescence, if something different, but certainly a measurement that, a type of scenario that is certainly present in the planet in our own solar system seem also to appear for extrasolar planet. And I'm happy to see there are several teams that have four ground-based telescopes at the moment. And I'm sure we'll know more about this feature, not only for this planet, but for many more. So what I'd like to see in the next 5 years, certainly would like to see more GJ1412b, because I agree that we really want to move into the realm of colder planets, and colder planets for which we can actually probe their atmosphere. And then, of course, there will be a next generation of ground and space-based telescope, and we'll all take advantage of that. I would personally also like to see a more dedicated mission, just that is staring basically at this transiting planet or combined lights, and specifically looking at the atmosphere, combining basically multiple wavelength regions, doing spectroscopy from the visible to the infrared, because at that point, we would be able, having a full dedicated mission, to really probe maybe 100 times, like it was proposed today, maybe 100 times light curves or a spectrum. And so at that point, we can really move on into real exoplanetary comparative exoplanetology. So I think I actually use all my time. To conclude, I would like just to say that at least for a handful of hot Jupiters that we're probing right now with photometry and spectroscopy, the idea that water vapor, methane, and CO are present is very, very likely, and also CO and hazes are very likely to be present. Now, personally, I don't think we can put too many constraints on what are the composition of these hazes. If it's TiO or VO or silicate or sulfur, I think also there we probably need more data to understand what is the real composition of all this. We have to bear in mind that there is a lot of degeneracy in the interpretation of the mixing ratio and the thermal profile. And so it's not about the overall components, the problem, but if you ask 10 minus 4 is the mixing ratio, 10 minus 5, then I need to be a little bit more cautious, just remind you about this degeneracy. We certainly need more data, higher resolution, and again, having space and ground working together will be really the way to go for having a breakthrough. And we also need beta line list, and I'm sure all the other modelers are actually agreeing with me on this. Thanks for your attention.
Okay, questions? Well, Heather's right here.
So could you go back to the IRTF slide?
Yeah.
So my question is actually about atmospheric water vapor. So one of the really big challenges about working in L-band is that the water vapor varies over the course of the night, and that gives you these time-varying signals in your data. So in looking at the light curves in the paper for this data set, I noticed that there were still some correlated noise in the data, and that correlated noise was largest at the wavelength where you see the biggest. So that peak of your emission function, also that's the messiest data. Can you comment on whether or not you've investigated whether you could have a false positive from atmospheric water variations?
Yes, okay. Quite frankly, there is we can probably push a little bit more even the reduction of those data. I think in the Nature paper, we were a little bit conservative because we just wanted to say there is a signal, is a huge signal compared to the other one. And we didn't push to have even higher resolution data. It's what we're trying to do right now, even with more data. So what I can tell you is that pushing a little bit more and having more data, some of the systematics can be removed, and actually even a more clearer signal can come out. The kind of technique that was used is explained in the paper is principal component analysis, and so somehow that part is not very sensitive to the water in the atmosphere. But again, there will be more observations, more planets, different groups. So all this will be, I guess, thought more in more depth.
Okay, we have Mark in the back.
Giovanna, you stressed some of the uncertainties in retrieving the abundances, but I think it's worth remembering there's a whole class of objects for which we have great spectra for in effective temperature range of 1,000 to 2,000 degrees, and we know from the last 15 years that we can in fact retrieve abundances, we can in fact match spectra pretty accurately, and that's the brown dwarfs, the L and T dwarfs. So we know, broadly speaking, the water line list works exceptionally well. We know the other, except for methane, we know that the line list work, we know that we can retrieve abundances. So I think it's important to remember that ground truth, that this is not an impossible problem. It's been solved in the case of the brown dwarfs. Of course, it's much more difficult, but there is a history of that.
No, I agree completely. I mean, I mentioned that there is really no problem about water. We both agree on that. Then CO2 is still not perfect, and CO2 I don't think was actually detected in brown dwarf. Correct me if I'm wrong. Now methane. For methane, I don't think we are at the level of knowing what is going on. I constantly talking with Linda Brown at JPL, Peter Benoth in the UK, Jonathan Tennyson is trying a CH4 line list, etc., etc. And the caution actually is coming more from them. And so I sort of agree on that. If I use, for instance, hydrogen-2008 methane, it's good because it's covering all the wavelength range from the visible to the far infrared. But then I compare that with the Nassar and Bernoth measurement of methane in the near infrared, and I see there is two order of magnitude. So I don't think we are at the level of being really able to retrieve mixing ratio, at least for methane. And for CO2, in my opinion, also, we need a little bit of caution.
Okay, Isabel.
Yes, Giovanna. There are those observations from David Singh concerning HD189 that you haven't mentioned, unfortunately, because you know they are not in agreement with the observational data of Swain. And in particular, there is this point at 1.66 micron, which actually literally kills the agreement you find between the models and the observations. So could you comment on that?
Yeah, I actually have a slide. The reason why. The reason why we think there is this disagreement is, first of all, we're talking about HD189733, which is a star that is actually very active. I mean, it's very spotty. And the measurements in the near infrared are certainly contaminated by spots, much more than what you have at near infrared, I would say. Now, when you take basically the spectrum, and this is what was done with NICMOS, basically you're taking at the same time simultaneously all the wavelengths. So we agree that the overall, level of the spectrum might change a little bit higher, a little bit lower because of the spots. But in relative, it's extremely strong, it's extremely accurate in relative. Now, here what David tried to do was actually to take two photometry bands at different times, putting together multiple transit, taking on top of that a two level of the activity of the star that was the maximum and the minimum. And so our point is, both the accuracy that you can reach with NICMOS when you come back and redo the observation, and the fact that the star is very active and is very spotty, and so David tried to remove the contribution of the spots. We're saying you need to be very careful in doing that. And so this two-band photometry taken at different time for a star that is very active, it's very hard that you can reproduce something at the level of accuracy for retrieving molecules. That's our point. And so that's why we don't think that those two particular observations can actually provide any hints. These are just slides showing some of the figures from the Singh paper. Well, it tried even just to reproduce one transit to put together multiple orbits of Hubble. You really need to be very careful in doing that. That was our point. But again, if the ground is becoming a new player, combined with space, we provide so many more observations that there will be a lot of time and possibilities to confirm all this.
Other questions? Okay, over to Nick.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, so just to follow up on that, that same poster out there with the same exquisite data set, apart from all the secondary eclipses that show that the hotspot doesn't move, we got a bunch of transits at 8 micron, and we actually showed that you do get some variability in the transits, even at just a constant wavelength over a baseline of about 2 years, and we think that's due to star spots and weird, like, second-order things. And I think that's going to ultimately set the limit on how well you can do with non-simultaneous transit spectroscopy.
Yes, could you comment briefly on the time scales, both thermal and chemical, required to restore equilibrium compared to the time, say, to flow from the day side to the night side at the sound speed?
I would love to. That's a key question. That's exactly what we are trying to push the observation to tell us. Because that's the thing, what we really don't know yet, at least. I mean, of course, we can model. Sorry?
You have a model of the atmosphere. In your model, you know from what pressure level certain features in the spectrum are coming. Do you know enough about the kinetics to be able to predict the rate?
Okay, well, that would be if you try to predict what's going on. What we're trying to do here for the moment is actually to try to see what the observations are telling us. So we are just trying to interpret the observation and doing some spectral retrieval. We are not imposing our priori model. Now, the observation at the moment are not able to tell us what's going on, but that's exactly where we want to move with the observation, constraining more basically what is the time scale of the dynamics with respect to the time scale of the photochemistry, for instance. So if some species which are formed photochemically then are quenched in some part of the atmosphere, or there is a very effective dynamics or less effective dynamics, I don't think that at the moment nobody can answer this question, but this is exactly what we all want to do in the next months and years, combining observation and more accurate models.
Okay, next from the chalkboard.
Yes, Giovanna, when we are observing a given planet, both in spectroscopy of the primary transit and of the secondary transit, we're probing two very different regimes. So for the transmission spectroscopy, really the high up atmosphere at the terminator, and for the day side secondary eclipse, it's deeper in the atmosphere, the global day side. Could you elaborate a little bit on the differences in what you're getting in terms of abundances and maybe temperatures? I don't know.
Yeah. Okay. Yes. Well, first of all, it's not entirely true that with transmission we don't probe too deep, because actually in the near infrared you sometimes can touch the bar level, and so somehow you can probe as deep as what you're doing on the day side. Now, in the question whether there is a chemical gradient from day and night and a thermal gradient day and night, again, I don't think it's very well constrained. I would love to know that, you know, more or less the chemistry doesn't change at all, and so I can use what we are probing on the night side, or at least the terminator, and use that as a prior for the day side, and so infer from that the thermal structure. But doing that, I'm imposing something I really don't know. And so presumably there is both a gradient, a thermal gradient and a chemical gradient. And again, having more and more observation, I hope they will tell us more about the situation.
The mic's coming to you.
Yeah, I'm Madhu Niku. I would like to add some more comments to the question. So on the thermal side, from what we find, you can constrain the temperature structure, compositions, and day-night redistribution all to a good extent. But if you're looking only at transmission spectra, you get good constraints on the molecular composition, but not very good constraints on the temperature structure. And you cannot constrain the day-night redistribution either in transmission. So if that helps.
Can we still have more time for questions? Okay, Renu?
So this is a question actually that's lingering in my mind from the previous talk. The light curves that Heather showed from over the orbital phase, Some of these hot Jupiters have this nice sinusoidal variation and some don't. And the interpretation was that some have atmospheric circulation and others, I'm not sure what that means. So I was wondering if, first of all, the simple explanation for that sinusoidal variation during the orbital phase is it actually confirming our prejudice that these are synchronously locked? And secondly, if the answer to that is yes, then the fact that some planets show this and others don't, would that be that some planets are synchronously locked and some are not? Does that make sense?
Okay, there are a lot of questions. For what concerns the dynamics, I will probably let the dynamicists that are present here to answer to you, because they can be much more accurate than I can be. Concerning the tidally locked, again, they're putative tidally locked, but also that needs to be confirmed by the observation. I don't think for the moment we have a clear idea if that is true or not. And second, these light curves produced by Heather are a wonderful constraint, but since we don't know yet completely if it's changing the opacity for the day to the night side, also that, you know, is relying also on what's going on in terms of the chemistry, so they're sort of coupled. So what I'm trying to say here is that it's complex, and the more observation we are having, the more we might be able to assemble the puzzle in a better way, but I don't think that nobody has the real answer at the moment. But maybe some of the dynamicists that are here wants to say something more. Exactly. For instance.
So I'm not a dynamicist, but I make those longitudinal maps, and you don't have to assume that the planet is tidally locked. You just have to assume that the weather is in a steady state, that the large-scale weather is in a steady state with respect to the substellar point, which is a whole different assumption. It could be, you could say that that's easier to get if the core of the planet is tidally locked, but at the photosphere, like at 8 micron, no one has any illusions that the parcels of gas are tidally locked. The parcels of gas are moving at like Mach 1 with respect to the tidally locked core, if it is tidally locked, right? So it's only a boundary condition for the people doing the dynamics. But I mean, those maps are true, provided that the weather is in a steady state, which subsequent data have shown it is. So the maps are okay. Interpreting them is a whole other can of worms.
But the question would be also my question. Is this enough to say it's tidally locked or it's not tidally locked? It's my impression that it's not enough. Yeah, that was my point.
I was pretty much going to say the same thing. I don't think the data are sufficient at this point to say whether they're tidally locked or not. I mean, it's plausible that they are, and the data certainly don't rule that out. But we'd need a lot more data and a lot better understanding of the circulation regime to say whether, from the data, whether tidal locking is occurring. Well, it's a zeroth order. I mean, if you have some atmospheres with very high opacities, where then the radiation to space is occurring from an extremely low pressure, then those planets potentially could have, and those very low pressures, the radiative time constant might be low, and you could plausibly imagine that those kinds of planets would have large day-night temperature differences. Whereas if you have a planet where the opacity is, such that the photons are coming from a much deeper level, then a planet like that could plausibly be homogenized. So that's just sort of a story. I mean, you need to back that up with actual, simulations and so on. But I don't think there's any problem having a range of behavior. Whether it actually falls into two real classes, we can't say yet, theoretically. It might be a continuum of behaviors, for example.
Okay, we have one last question.
Not just a quick comment. For this planet, tidally locked means the planet will be in a synchronous state of rotation. Synchronization doesn't occur for gaseous planets. It occurs only for solid planets. These planets are gaseous, so they are in a pseudo-synchronous location. I mean, they're pseudo-synchronously locked. They're not in a locked rotation, but the time scale for solar synchronization is very rapid. So it's very unlikely that the planet is not in a state of solar synchronization. So I don't think that. And on the other hand, the time scale for circularization is very fast. So I don't think that's the.
But the fact there are some hot Jupiters that are actually with an eccentricity should show us that maybe not all of them are actually synchronized or pseudo-synchronized.
Yeah, some of them might not be pseudo-synchronized, yes, but most of them should be.
Okay, so we've had a long day. We've had a lot of good talks, a lot of good audience participation. So thank you to Giovanna, the speakers, and yourselves. See you bright and early tomorrow.